Hi, this is Kurt Scher from Millstone Cellars in Maryland, and you're listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode 20. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am your Cider MC. This is a weekly podcast where we speak to cider makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade around the world. And this week, we'll be chatting with Kurt Scher from Millstone Ciders in Maryland. For any one of us thinking about barrel aging cider, this is a really exciting chat to get in on because he just inspired me to roll out my own barrel and just start going at it and gave some good ideas on just cider making tips. And certainly you're going to get some real thirst for Millstone ciders and think about getting a little cider trip going down there. But we'll get back to that chat in just a moment. A lot has been happening in this little bit of time since I last walked down the lane, one orchard lane that is, into Ciderville with you, and I want to catch up a little bit on that. Of course, you might have heard last week that Cider Chat does have a sponsor, and their name is Cider Cellars. That's a cellar as in where you keep your barrels of cider. So that's CELLARS. They import UK ciders to the US, and that's a really nice way to begin really honing in on your palate and seeing some of the amazing bitter sweets and bitter tarts that they have in those different blends. So do check them out at cidercellars.com. And then the other thing that happened, or there's a couple things that happened. There's a bunch of Facebook likes. And when I say a bunch, I'm meaning about, I think about 5 or 8. And we are now over 100 likes on Cider Chat. I really dig that little community there because I post stuff up there that I don't really post anywhere else. So if you go there now, you'll see a posting from this weekend's chat that I had with Jim Wallace. It's going to be an upcoming podcast, and this guy is a cheese man. And then there were some new likes, and these people brought us over to 100 likes. So I want to thank Chris Jackson, Sam Nightingale, Mike Rees, and Jeff Zellick. All cool people, and welcome to Ciderville. Welcome to Cider Chat. And then the other neat thing that happened, it actually happens every week, and it kind of tied into something else. A weekly email goes out via Eric West and his blog, which is Cider Guide. And he puts out this email every Friday where he does a synopsis of cider news that's happening around the world. And he really fits it in. He puts a list of 10, but like on number 10, he actually lists a number of different reviews there at the end. So if you're into reviewing cider, that's pretty cool to look at. And he mentions all the amazing bloggers. You know, some of those folks are like Meredith at Along Came Cider. And then there's also a whole bunch of other folks that do things like the Cider Journal. And they looked at a Sidra from 2014. The Cider Says does a little piece on Woodchuck Day Chaser and Shillings and, yeah, Woodchuck. And then also the Milled Apple. And then there was Love Thy Cider Reviews, also the Woodchuck Day Chaser. So you could kind of compare those notes. And then the Bad Writer Reviews. That's writer as in like writing in a car. And Real Cider Reviews from Australia. That's, I believe, Hugh. He was talking about Flying Brick Draft Cider. And there's some great stuff happening out of Australia. So that's cool to check out. But what happened is he's been mentioning, not always, but he has mentioned the Cider Chat podcast. So thank you very much for that, Eric. And there was also a little cider audio roundup. And that was written by Dan Dougherty. And his blog is called Cider Sage, like a sage that you would follow, or is also spelled the same way as a sage that one would burn. And he could be found on Twitter at Cider Sage. Well, Dan wrote this little piece, and of course I had to check it out because it said audio, and I'm thinking, well, I'm hoping that Cider Chat is mentioned, of course, because we are audio. And what I found was this nice little piece that he wrote on the different podcasts out there. And there's not really that many. There was one that is missed. So that's the guys from Edinburgh. So I'm going to make a little link to them. And they both are drinking ciders and talking about it at the same time. But what he wrote about Cider Chat just made me so smile, and I hope it'll make you smile too. And this is what he wrote. He says, I have to admit that I am a bit late to the Cider Chat podcast party. Okay, he didn't say party. I'm saying party because I feel it is like a party. But that one like little piece there, calling this a party, is so right on, because it is. You know, in the land of Ciderville, we find that everything is possible, and we're just having a hell of a lot of fun finding the best in every cider and sharing amazing tips and resources with cider makers. He went on with saying, I don't have a lot to say about it yet, talking about the podcast. That won't last long, however. I've started into the content generated from CiderCon 2016, and I like what I hear. Dude, you made my day. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to Ciderville. You're awesome. You're awesome on what you do. And you're good looking too. And we're all good looking in Ciderville. That's just granted. All right. I want to just mention that. And then the other thing was, of course, whenever we see a nice review on iTunes, and this is something I'd like to encourage all you folks to do, is, you know, leave a little review. It really helps move the podcast forward. We heard this from N. Shackelford, and this person wrote, great content for cider people. Rhea has done a great job tracking down diverse people from the cider scene. Her tone is fun and casual, and she chats with her own cider knowledge and understanding as a backdrop. As a home cider maker and hobbyist, I can't get enough of cider conversation. Thumbs up. Thank you so much. That was so kind of you to take the time to go into iTunes and leave a review and rating, and a 5-star review and rating. Really makes a big difference on so many different levels, and gives me a smile that lasts a long while. And that's what cider's all about. Sharing a smile that lasts a long while. Yeah. So what do you say? Shall we go down to Maryland and have a little chit-chat with Kurt? I think so. I'm feeling parched. Let's grab a glass and join this chat. Maryland's kind of an interesting state in the way it's kind of, you know, situated. So what part of Maryland is Millstone?
We're just south of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And we're actually considering becoming a Pennsylvania winery, because you actually can be a Pennsylvania winery without having your winery in Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
And yeah, that's what I said. But that's been confirmed many times.
Yeah, I'm not sure what benefit that would be, because I know the Pennsylvania Cider Guild and what they're doing there, they're having a little bit of difficulty with some of the laws in Pennsylvania are kind of restrictive, but maybe you're kind of like dual citizenship here. Is that what we're
looking at? That's sort of what I think we'll end up with. Right now, we are not distributed in Pennsylvania, just because that is one of the problems, is just the distribution issues. But we actually would like to join the Pennsylvania Cider Guild and maybe attend some of their festivals. Most of our fruit actually comes from Pennsylvania.
Oh.
So we're more of a Pennsylvania cidery than...
Because of the location that you're, it's easier to transport it from there.
Right. We source everything within 50 miles as far as our apples. We'll go to 150 miles to get the honeys we want from southern New Jersey. But from apples, we're getting like Adams County, York County. One of the problems we found with Maryland apples, because we would love to support the Maryland apple industry, is that they have to pasteurize their juice by law. And we're like, can't take it, not interested. So, and you know what, there's 20,000 acres just in Adams County of fruit trees. So a huge resource just across the border.
So you're buying juice. You're not pressing.
We have gotten into doing our own pressing.
Okay.
And we've always pressed our specialty fruits, like plums, tangerines, peaches, pears, you name it, you know, cherries, raspberries. Mm-hmm. We've always pressed those. But we did get an old orchard equipment press from Shelburne Orchards. It's a 1960s plate, the cloth and frame.
Yeah.
And love that press. But we do source a lot of our own apples locally, out of backyards, abandoned orchards. Sure. Sneak into somebody's pasture and grab the apples. Mm-hmm. And so those we crush them and we do our own pressing with those.
How long has it been open?
We started fermenting in the 2011 season. We started selling in the fall of 2012.
Okay. And how about yourself? How did you come into cider making?
Oh, it's a long, long road. So I actually made wine in high school. I was in organic chemistry in high school, and one of the projects was to make wine. So this is when legal drinking age was 18, so that goes way back.
Yeah.
And I was just fascinated by the process. Got a job at a local winery, found out that that you could actually go to school for that. So I ended up going to UC Davis back in the early 80s, got a degree in fermentation science, and also a degree in viticulture. And so I was making wine in Virginia in the 80s, Piedmont Vineyards and then Bird Vineyards, both of them are now defunct, but made some absolutely wonderful wines. My one claim to fame from that period was I made a Chardonnay that earned a 91 from Robert Parker, which it was an awesome year for grapes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really was, but it was interesting because at that point I was like, wow, that wasn't that hard, you know, to do that. Because, you know, it's not so much what the winemaker or the cider maker does, it's what kind of fruit comes in the door. If you're getting quality fruit coming in the door, it, you know, as you've heard, it's yours to screw up. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely true. Even with, and you can have the best vineyard or orchard in the world also, and, you know, you could screw that up so that you're actually not getting the best fruit out of that, and that's an issue.
Right. Yeah.
But so I did the winemaking for 10 years, got out of that, went back to school for chemical engineering and biochemical engineering, and then I got a job at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office doing the alcoholic beverage patent application. So,
wow.
Yeah, that was fun. Did that for 12 years. I loved that job. And across my desk came both Zima, if you remember Zima, people might not terribly high quality, but that's not what the patent office is not about, high quality.
Right.
And then the other thing that I did was the ice beer, which everybody makes ice beer now. And so I just love that job. And they put me through law school at night, and somewhere in there, I bought an old...
My goodness.
Yeah, it's been a busy
life. You're like a real super achiever. So you have a law degree, too?
Yeah.
Wow, right on.
Yeah.
That's great.
I'm actually a Maryland attorney, but absolutely don't... Please, nobody call me for legal advice. And so it was mostly intellectual property law, which I love that also. Patent law, trademarks, copyright, just love that.
Can we talk a little bit about that, though, in terms of trademark for, you know, is there like a short answer for cideries to be thinking about on that, because branding is so important? I see this happening in the craft beer world where all of a sudden, like, no, you have to stop using that.
Oh, yeah.
And it could definitely happen in the cideries, too.
It's already happened to us. We decided to use the term hopricot on one of our products. Well, Mr. Nat West has the trademark on that. And so we got a letter saying, please stop. And I gave him shot him an email and I said, yes, we will stop. And he said, cool. Mm-hmm. And so you really have to research what sort of names you want to use. Mm-hmm. And there's all levels of protectability in trademarks. Mm-hmm. And when you are picking a name for your cidery or meadery or whatever, you got to put a lot of time into that. You know, don't just take the first thing that pops up in your head. I mean, really check it out and make sure it's protectable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is critical. And then when you get your labels, your package design is important also.
Right. You can't go forward without thinking about that. And it's not just the names, but also logos, too.
Oh, logos,
and
slogans.
Those are two different kinds of copyrights, too, with that.
Yeah. I mean, the... intellectual property can be rather complex.
It can. But it's simple enough for folks to go in and fill out those forms themselves. Do you think that it's necessary to always hire an attorney for that? I know a lot of folks to fill out the forms.
No, copyrights and trademarks are not too hard. Now, if the trademark office comes back and says, we're not going to let you register this because we feel it's, say, generic, mm-hmm. you might want to get an attorney to go in and represent you mm-hmm. If you have to do that. If there's litigation, you could definitely. But those folks are very expensive.
Yes, they are. Yeah, yeah. I've done a bit for another business I have.
Oh, okay.
I have some international copyrights and
good
on intellectual property that I've written. So I know that process. But I think it's a really key thing to be thinking about for cideries and as they're moving forward. So let's get back to Millstone, though, and yourself. So
right. So I finished law school. I was like, okay, now what am I going to do to stay busy? And so I bought an old grist mill in Moncton, Maryland. And it had been an antique shop and obviously a grist mill before that, going back to like the 1850s. And it was in really bad shape. So we fixed up the mill and the miller's house, really without knowing what the heck I was going to use it for. It was just, I just love old things, and I love fixing up old things.
Cool.
At some point, I was like, okay, we're almost done after like 6 or 8 years of working on it. And I said, well, you know, let's go back in the fermentation business. Let's do wine. It's just like, you know, been there, done that. I was not really interested in doing that, especially in Maryland. And said, well, what else can we do? And just going like, well, this is an old grist mill. What were they doing 100 years ago around here? Well, they were doing hard cider, of course.
Yes.
And it's just like,
yeah.
And to me, it was just like, well, apple wine. I've done apple wine, you know, sweet apple wine, not interested. But it was just like, you know, it kicked around my brain and kicked around. It was just like, you know, maybe there's another way we can do this. Maybe you can get something a little bit closer to maybe Chardonnay. And so that was the goal. Let's take apple juice and see how close we can get to making a Chardonnay. And so that was our whole tack. From day one, we were using used whiskey barrels that had basically had no flavor in them. We actually got them from a cidery up in up in Connecticut. So basically no flavor in the barrels. They were just fermentation containers. And the other thing we did that was a little bit along the lines of making wine is we kept every variety separate. Because this is what I don't understand is that a lot of people will get their apples and they'll go like, well, you want so much dessert, so much bittersweet, so much crabs, and that's, and then they sort of guess and then they put it all through their crusher. Well, what did you learn from that? Not a whole lot. You know, but if you keep it all separate in the barrel and you blend at the end,
blending it down.
I know what Stamen Wine Sap will do. I know what Rome Delicious will do. And, you know, so we've worked with about 20 different varieties and we keep them all separate.
Yeah.
The other beautiful thing that this has allowed us to do, because where we are in the cider timeline is that really nobody knows a whole lot. I mean, people might say they know a lot, but unfortunately they really don't. It's all been lost. You know, unless you can reincarnate somebody who was making cider from 100 years ago, it's all gone. So you really don't know what Jonathan can do. And you don't know what it can do at different maturity levels. And you don't know what it'll do on different yeasts. So we'll have 20 barrels of Jonathan, and it's all the same. And we're basically doing experimentations at the barrel level. And we did about 20 different yeasts. Last year, we did beer yeast of all kinds. We did cider yeast. We did wine yeast. We did sherry yeast. We did, I mean, you name it, we tried it. Mm-hmm. And I'll just tell you that what we came down with is about 4 wine yeasts are just incredible. The beer yeasts were they weren't exciting. And at all. They weren't distinctive. And that's what we're looking for, is something that's very distinctive. We end up with just about every barrel ends up being about different, and which is really nice. So if you think of it from like a cooking aspect, where you go in to make a meal at night, you open your fridge, your spice chest, and you just have all these different flavors to work with that you can then create a meal. That's what we're doing when we're blending. We sit down with maybe 50 different barrels, And we'll pick maybe 15 or something for the final blend.
All barrels, Kurt? Is that?
That's all we do is barrels.
You're not using any stainless?
Stainless for blending. Okay. So at some point we need to blend up 1,000 gallons. And that's one thing that they didn't have 150 years ago. You know, they drank it barrel by barrel by barrel. Mm-hmm. We can actually do a blend, but we have no... I mean, you know, if you're looking to save money, to do what we do, all you need is a barrel. Mm. You don't need a chiller.
50-gallon barrels.
50 gallons if you want to use a 30-gallon, whatever you can get your hands on. You know, a racking hose would be nice.
Sure.
But, you know, if you once again, you think back 100 years, they didn't have running water. Yeah. They didn't have filters. They were not fining. They weren't using sulfur dioxide. Mm-hmm. They weren't pasteurizing. I mean, a lot of them weren't even bottling either. But I mean, that does throw another aspect into the equation.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting. So you have, how many barrels do you have?
So we were up to about 400 barrels this year.
Wow. And what kind of storage space?
We got up to about 13,000 gallons in the mill itself, and then we were just packed. It's not a big mill. Yeah. And so we went into another facility, which is not a facility that I would recommend. It's basically an industrial warehouse. And it just, you know, for temperature control, it's really not working. So we've been looking for another home to do a moderate expansion to get up to like 20 or 25,000 gallons. I think it's what we can do and still maintain and continue improving our quality.
Yeah, yeah.
But you really want basement area. I mean, once again, you want a cellar.
Cool, yeah.
Just like a winery.
Yeah, keeping it cool.
Yeah.
Are there basements in Maryland?
Basements? Yeah. Not too many. We found a facility up just a little bit north of us, actually. We were very fortunate. It's about a 33,000 square foot old paper mill that has a lot of basement to it.
Okay.
And that's like my number one attraction to that facility. But it's a beautiful facility, and I hope we end up getting it.
The
possibilities are endless, and we're all about possibilities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I like what you're offering here as some great tips to really separating out the variety, which only contributes to the cider maker's knowledge base and taste profile. And then what a lot of folks, they think blending, and they're thinking at that initial process, but really the blending comes in afterwards.
And that's the problem when you invest in, like, you know, 1,000, 3,000 gallon tanks, you're stuck. Mm-hmm. Whatever you blended, that's it. It's in your tank. You really don't have many more options.
Right.
And once again, we're all about possibilities and options, and we want to keep it open until the very last moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've worked with about 20 different apple varieties, and, you know, I can grade them by, you know, C plus, B, B minus, all the way up. Mm-hmm. And you just learn so much.
Mm-hmm.
You learn about how maturity matters. You learn about doing maceration. How does that change it? And so you can do half your juice macerated, half not. You can do free run.
Let's slow down a little bit. Because new folks coming new into Ciderville, maceration,
is when you crush up, grind up your apples, and you just let them sit there as pulp, pumice some people call it, and just let it sit there, and very traditional, 24 hours, 2 days. YouTube is a great place to look up some videos to see what traditional, let's say in Europe, and I've seen some, especially in northern Spain, where they fill up their press, and they don't even apply the pressure. They just let it sit in the press, and it slowly drains. The next day, they put on the pressure, and they'll spend the whole day pressing. Then they'll open it up. They'll turn it over. They'll repress it. So it's like a 3 or 4 day process.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's like from the winemaking tradition. You have that, like, initial free flow where you crush the grapes, and you have, I would make wine with just that, and then press it, and then make it with that. So it's the same kind of concept that you have different, I'm not going to say purity levels, but you have different kind of vitality of that juice that's going to come through.
Once again, we want every barrel to be as different as possible to give us as many options. And we've been in the learning phase for 5 years, and it's going to be another 5 years. So, you know, what I'm telling you today, talk to me in 5 years, there'll be a lot of differences.
Well, I look forward to that.
Yeah.
Coming to Millstone, if you have a tasting room?
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of imagining that there's probably quite a few different ciders to try, because you must have a lot of variety coming out all the time.
Yeah, and we'll add pretty much whatever we can get locally. So we're very fortunate that we have somebody up the road, 10 miles up the road, doing hops. So we have our hop vine. We get local baby ginger growing in hoop houses. Nice. That's organic, which baby ginger is totally different than regular ginger. Mm-hmm. Much less heat, more floral. Mm. So that's a really nice product to work with. Nice. We work with local orchards that will, I mean, a lot of times they'll go like, oh, well, we have all these peaches. We're getting ready to throw them out in the field. Do you guys want them? We're like, oh, yes, we do.
Yeah.
And so we get these super ripe peaches, pears, and cherries. Wow. I mean, it just goes on and on. And we'll source things like spice bush is a local native plant that the Indians use. You know, you have that sumac, staghorn sumac granule.
Yeah.
We'll harvest that off the side. We don't get it off the side of the road. There's other places we can get it. But it's a chock full of vitamin C.
Yeah.
The Indians were making tea out of it. We throw it into the cider.
Right.
And a lot of times we actually do fermentations with that, especially the fruit. Any fruit that we're getting in will ferment on the skins if it's cranberries, things like that. But so we'll have, come to the tasting room, we'll have like 7 things to try.
Nice.
And some of them are sizers, so we do add in some honey. We occasionally have our meads to try. Our meads are like the ugly stepchild. Hopefully there's no stepchildren listening. So we just don't have time for that. And what I have found exciting is the ciders. I'm just blown away by the potential quality there.
Yeah.
I really am.
Yeah, that's exciting. So the tasting room itself, folks that come in and maybe get a fly, because, you know, Ciderville, I hear these listeners are saying, tell us what's going on so that they know when they arrive there what to expect. So it's like in an old building, right?
Right. It's in the old mill. And so some people just come for like the history and they just, especially the locals, they just love the building. But it could be like a half hour tour, depending on how busy it is.
So there are tours there?
Oh, yeah. And it's free tours and tastings, only open on the weekends. Right from the get-go, we decided not to charge just for those people who are in the business, because we found that basically if they try it, they will buy it. Why bother putting that roadblock in front of them where you got to give me $5? Oh, if you buy something, you get it back. We're such a new product and it requires so much education that we just have to trust that people, when they hear what we do, that they will just, you know, they'll find it really attractive. And they do. I mean, we started about $16 a bottle and go up from that. So for a 750 milliliter bottle.
Okay.
So not necessarily cheap, but I mean, for what we put into it and the quality, it's really a good deal.
Yeah. And so is it all 750 mil bottles? Are they corked too?
We do swing tops.
Okay.
And so we did that early on for many reasons. First off, cider is not wine. Cider is not beer. It's neither. It's its own standalone thing.
Yeah.
But so he said, well, let's get something that's sort of in between the two. Yeah. So we have the clear bottles, which actually is a good thing because our product is always cloudy. We have the probiotics floating around in there. And, so it's dirty cider.
How do you explain that to the customer?
Most people have no problem.
That's good for folks to hear.
Yeah, because cider is so new, it can be what it wants to be.
Yeah, right,
you know?
Right.
And that's one problem I have. I come across as a little too negative too often. But that people are trying to say, this is cider. It's like, you know, we've only been doing this for like 5 years, and why should we start drawing lines in the sand?
Mm.
Let cider develop as the customer wants it. And people like having the cloudiness. So it's not a problem
for
them.
I mean, if you think about, there's a couple things that I wanted to just mention. Certainly, there's craft beer like a Hefeweizen. You want to shake up some of that sediment on the bottom, and that's a correct pour for it.
Right.
But also, when craft beer was initially coming out, they weren't filtering it to like pull that out.
Right.
And in some ways, you're thinking about a lot of nutrients that are in there too.
True.
So it's kind of a, you know, I don't mind drinking that. And then the other piece, just going on to the tasting room, I think that was an interesting point that you don't charge for that sampling. And
right.
I want to say that as in the craft industry, I'm seeing that a little bit more than I have seen it in the past. I haven't necessarily seen that with cideries, but I am seeing that because for that same factor that you get the folks in there, and then they're going to walk out the door with something. And the benefit from that is they're walking out the door with that, and they're bringing that out into the world even further than you could if it was just right there. Right. And then they're like, what was that we had? I don't know. It was good. It was something from Millstone. Yeah, I don't know what, but you know. But when they have the bottle, it's sitting there and they're going with it. And so I think there's a lot of value to that, and it's a good tip for folks opening cideries to think about.
Right. I mean, once again, we're very much in the education business, yeah. And that's part of the way you educate. You don't put up barriers. And, you know, there's a cost associated with it, and that's what you do when you educate.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you been over to the UK drinking ciders?
No, I have not.
Yeah.
I don't get out much.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I used to.
Okay.
Not anymore.
Because, I mean, they have been making cider for a really long time, so we do have a marker in that way.
Right. I love the Sidras, and I think they're probably closest to what we're doing.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. I know there's the traditional English ciders, mm-hmm. and, you know, I've tasted what's come across the pond, and I wouldn't necessarily call most of those traditional. But, I mean, it's hard to...
English ciders?
Yeah, I mean, but I'm...
What you're probably able to get. Might
exactly.
I see.
Right.
Yeah.
If I was to go to England and visit all the little cideries, I'm sure I would find those traditionals. I mean, we make a very rustic product. We add nothing to it. So, nothing. Okay.
So
one thing we might add is a commercial yeast. And even there, we have not added sulfur dioxide to the juice, so all that wildness is still in the juice.
Yeah, okay.
We've just added another strain of organism, and a dominant strain, obviously.
Yeah.
But some, we don't do that for all of our barrels. A lot of our barrels, we just let them go wild. And it's sort of interesting, because wild fermentations are like 20 organisms, all going at it, you know, fighting for dominance. And so what you get is this broad base of complexity. But then when you do the commercial yeast, you get like these spikes. And you might go like, wow, this one just has like pineapple or something. And this one has melons or something. Mm-hmm. And so then, once again, it's fun to blend those afterwards, because then you can get like spikes of flavors, but then you get that broad base of complexity.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
once again, you know, it's all about possibilities.
Yes, I love that term. I do, yes.
Well, Kurt doesn't know how familiar that saying is to me, because I always think about Nelson Mandela and how he would say, it's only impossible until it's done. And I just really dig how Kurt is feeling about cider making, about really going for possibilities. And that's not just about cider making, but in life in general. And I could wax poetically about that all day, but let's get back to the cider piece here. We're going to be chatting with Kurt about barrel aging, a bit more about that, and also there'll be made mention of a particular magazine that you might have heard of that featured Millstone Cellars, and I will have a link to that in the show notes. A lot more good info coming up on this chat. And I'd like to just say that there is a lot of information here. It goes pretty quickly. So I try to get some of it into the show notes. But if you're interested in having some of these episodes transcribed, do let me know, because I'd like to hear from you about your thoughts on having transcribed episodes that you could download via ciderchat.com. Let's get back to this chat now with Curtis Shear from Millstone Cellars in Maryland.
So the barrels, you're reusing them.
Yes.
And probably doing some cleaning in between. Not a whole lot. So you are, in essence, having your own type of floral, you know, yeast profile coming out of your cidery. Are you finding at this point that there is a particular yeast that's dominating right now?
Well, it's interesting, because we get... our apples from many different sources, and especially what I call our community cider, which is what we get out of people's backyards and abandoned orchards and sides of road. And every location is going to give us a different regimen of organisms.
Mm-hmm.
If we just got from the one, and actually even the one
cider presser that we get it from. He's actually sourcing things throughout all of Adams County and York County. And so once again, really diverse. And it's just the complexity that's going on in there. I don't even know how to begin to quantify that.
Interesting.
And to keep track of it.
Right.
I mean, can't. At this point, there's no way we can.
And is there a cider that you're always making, or are they always different?
We do have three main lines. We have the Farm Gate, which is just pure apples. We have the Hop Vine, as I mentioned. Then we have the Ginger Root, which is the baby ginger.
Okay, just slow down a minute. So you have the pure apples.
Right, Farm Gate.
Farm Gate.
Right.
How does that, what are you defining by pure apples?
There's nothing added.
The Hop Gate?
The Hop Vine.
Hop Vine.
Yep. And which is just hops.
Just hops.
Yep.
And how are you working with hops? Are you doing the flowers then? Because you're getting it locally sourced?
Yeah. And sometimes we get them to where they don't even, we'll get them green. So they'll pull them off within a day of being pulled off the vine. Mm-hmm. We're putting them in the cider. Mm-hmm. And we let it soak for like, you know, a week, 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Just keep tasting it and seeing when it's ready.
Where you like it. And then I know that some folks really try to then bottle it very quickly because once they find that certain point, they want to get into the bottle so it doesn't keep on, you know, lack of a better word, off-gassing or just dissipating the floral smell of that hop. Do you find that's true for yourself, or
it's an interesting point. When we first started hopping, we actually hopped the barrels, and you try and get 2 pounds of hops through a little bunghole, and then try and get it back out.
Eek.
We quickly learned that was a bad idea.
So
then we started doing it really at the end, where we blend up our base cider that we want, and then we add the hops to it. But I don't see as there's a rush. I mean, that's just sort of optimum for us as far as production to do it that way. And then we normally add either honey, a little bit of honey, or we will add what I call cryo cider. So we make our own apple concentrate, you know, the big IBCs, freezing it, thawing it. And so that will be what we add to those products.
How do you do that? Do you put it in a big cooler? Or
yeah, we have there's a freezer. ice facility up in New York County, actually.
No kidding. Wow.
So, and they actually also store lots of apples in the same facility.
No
so
kidding.
It works out really well.
Wow. So what temperature are you putting that into?
Oh, they'll take it down to zero. And that's actually something that we've not really optimized. It's just the production of cryo cider. There's a lot of nuances to making that, and especially doing it efficiently.
Yeah.
And once again, we do it so it's like Stamen Wine Sap cryo cider, Rome Beauty cryo cider. So we actually can get specific varieties of that, which, once again, it's another nuance that we need to look into. There's so many aspects to making hard cider that, you know, even a rustic hard cider, you would think, oh, it's just such a simple thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many variations to play with that, you know, it just, you know, the next 5 years, 20 years, I'm going to be real busy.
And having a heck of a lot of fun that process. I could feel it. You know, your enthusiasm is really, really awesome.
We love what we do. The people who work with Millstone really enjoy the experimentation. Every day something changes. So we get a new piece of equipment. We bring in a new type of apple. We try a new yeast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we get a new type of bottle. And, every day something changes, and we're always looking to make it better.
So before I forget this question, I want to just go back to your tasting room. Is there food there available, or food in the area?
We're working on that.
Come by. You probably don't have food trucks like they do in a more you're more country, right? Isn't it?
Yes,
country?
We've had food trucks come up occasionally, but that would be a special event for us.
Okay.
Right now, we don't have a whole lot of interesting food that matches well with our cider, and that's something we're working on because our cider is much more of a food product. Than you know, the sweeter ciders.
I mean,
the sweeter ciders certainly have a place in the culinary arts, and that's great. But for something that you want to go with, like a really nice pizza or just like wine. And so that's something we're working on. What we do is we have a lot of tables set out, and people will bring up their lunch or early dinner, and we are on tap. So we're selling glasses of cider, and people are just having little parties there.
Great, lovely.
So it's a good time.
Okay, so that's good for folks to know if they're coming by to like kind of brown bag it or bring their dinner. And then I'm sure it's a beautiful old mill. My goodness, it must be a lovely spot to
sit outside. We actually made it into Martha Stewart's Living. So they did a 4-page spread on us, which blew us away. Yeah. I don't know how that happened. It just, they came for 3 days for a photo shoot. That was quite a trip.
Yeah.
Well, so that was very fun.
That's awesome for you. Cool.
Yeah.
So when you're out in the world, well, it sounds like you're kind of like a little home base there. But when people come in for the first time and they say, oh, you know, I want to come here, what's cider?
Right.
How do you describe that?
Well, I sort of let everybody define what cider is. I mean, I talk about what our cider is. And normally when they come up for the tasting, I say, have you ever had Angry Orchard or Woodchuck or some sweet cider? And if they're like, oh, yes, I have. And it's like, okay, well, wash that away from your mind, because this is not it. This is going to be bone dry. What I would like you to think about is what you're having for dinner tonight, and let's try and find something that will pair well with that. Okay, with that in their mind, then they start tasting it, and almost everyone, I mean, invariably 1 out of 5 will go like, wow, that's different.
Yeah.
And it is. What we do is so different than what everybody else does. Once again, we add nothing to the juice. It goes into the barrel from day one. It will stay in that barrel for 8 months, maybe a year. And so all it will go through malolactic fermentation. Mm-hmm. It is a live product.
Mm-hmm.
We strip nothing out of that juice. You're not gonna get a more pure cider than what we're making. And that's all we do.
Well, see, that's what is a little bit of a key thing to be hearing in what Kurt is mentioning here, is that it's a live food.
Yep.
And that means that the yeast is still active, even so it's bottled conditioning.
Yes.
And that's what really sets it apart. I know that there are some wines that are like that, but people will really often equate cider making with wine making. And you know, my own personal view is that it's its own entity.
Yes.
You might use some of the same processes, but when you're doing something like what you're doing and keeping it as a live food, that really separates it out, because you're not going to find that with, you know, all the sulfites. Not all the sulfites. I don't want to create that image for wines are pumped with sulfites, but they're stopping fermentation is probably the best way to say that.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of a negative way to think about it, but they're sort of dead. And when I went to UC Davis, that is what they tell you, how to make a stable bottle of wine that, you know, is going to be clear, it's going to stay clear, and you need to use, you know, tight filtration, you need to use sulfur dioxide. Mm. If you're going to do it sweet, you probably add some sorbate to it. And when you start looking at cider, once you say, I'm not going to make anything with residual sugar, there's all sorts of things you don't have to do.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to use any sulfites. You don't have to fine. You don't have to filter. I mean, just on and on. Just get a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's one of the things that sort of bothers me, is I don't think that message is getting out to people.
Yeah.
That, you know, once again, think about 100 years ago, because that was good cider 100 years ago.
Yeah.
That's all you need.
Uh-huh.
And then,
well, how do you know it was good cider 100 years ago?
They said it lasted. I'll tell
okay,
you why.
All right,
so you would say, like, well, what book? Where did you learn how to do this? The books I learn out of are like from 1825, and I sat in on the Tom Oliver Perry discussion yesterday, and he was talking about the books he reads. They're like from before the turn of the previous century, and those are the books I read. And they talk about how cider would last 10 years in the bottle. And I can tell you, ours would last, without sulfur dioxide, easily 5 at this point. And that they rivaled the white wines of France. I mean, I'll get those quotes for you. I can't tell you what page and book I got those out of. But I have I probably have 10 or 12 books. Old books. Mm-hmm. That's what I've learned. And what I find really interesting is I from our own learning, I'll go like, oh, you know, you can, and I heard this from Tom Oliver yesterday also, is that you could take fruit that has started to like decompose from the inside out. The skin's not broken. It's not infected with molds. And that we find that so we're picking them up off the ground in the orchard.
Yeah.
And we're throwing those to the side. And I look at one, and it's like, well, what the heck? I bite into that. And it was like a peaty scotch. on a Jonathan apple. It's not the same for every apple.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And it was just like, wow. It's like, guys, you know, girl, make sure you get some of those into it. And so you get a lot of flavor when you get super ripe apples.
Yeah,
And that is what I consider super ripe.
Yeah.
And so once again, I thought we were discovering something. I read about it in a book. That was what they did in the old days. They would wait till they started turning brown.
Right. Well, you're rediscovering something.
That's
and
right.
That and that passion will really go forward and really contribute a lot to the world of cider. So are your ciders still, or if they're bottle conditioned?
We do both.
Okay. So if somebody gets that, can they expect 5 years down the line that there's going to be a slight effervescence there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it'll still be there. And it's interesting. People will try the cider and I'm like, oh, I just love this. And I say, well, drink it quick because it'll change in 2 months.
Sure.
It's a live product and it's constantly evolving. That's, to me, that's sort of a fun thing.
Right, right. Well, that is what I'm hearing is very unique about your product is that it is live, and a lot of the ciders that are out on the market aren't.
Right.
Not that there aren't some of that, but that's kind of a unique thing, and I think that anyone listening out there in Ciderville really wants to go and check out and come down to Maryland to try those ciders, because is there distribution out further?
We are in Virginia, we're in D.C., we're all throughout Maryland, we're in Delaware, we're in New York, and we are in California.
Okay.
And
Southern California or Northern California?
They get us up into San Francisco. I'm not sure about their total distribution there. And a lot of why we do that is just to get the word out that this is the other end of cider. Because, you know, I see cider as, you know, this continuum. And, you know, yes, Angry Orchard's at one end. We're way at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have everything in between.
Yeah.
And it's all good stuff. I mean, it's not like one is right and one isn't.
Right.
It's, you know, if you're having food for, you know, you're not going to necessarily have Angry Orchard. Millstone's probably going to go really, really well with it.
And, you know, just to be fair to Angry Orchard, they do have their, like, you know, standard that goes out for a lot of folks. But I was at the tasting the other night, and Ryan Burke, who's a cider maker, was pouring something off of a cognac barrel that, you know, he's not adding anything into it.
Good.
So there's definitely in that the Boston Beer Company, which, you know, is kind of that ethic of really going there, I think that we will see some of the stuff that you're doing in that way with their products. So I think even the large ones are taking note of that and going towards that cider making. But, you know, they're very large, so they're going to have something for a larger public audience in that way. And it's all good because we're all rising with the same tide.
Right. The issue that's going to hold all of us back is the fruit.
Say more.
Well, just getting, once again, this is very much like winemaking, grape winemaking, is it's all about the fruit. And you have to harvest it when it's ripe. If I go to a tree and I yank the apple, you know, the apple's fighting to hang on to it, but I yank it off, and I make cider out of that versus waiting for that apple to drop and collecting it off the ground a month later, night and day. We did Granny Smith, you know, which most people be like, oh, why would you work with Granny Smith? Well, we did a few barrels just to see what it would do.
Yeah.
We were nonplussed about it. I went into our old orchard in early November, and it was getting dark. The snow was coming. I was getting whatever I could. And we got these Granny Smith, and they were 18% sugar. They had this nice little red blush to the apple. So this wasn't your typical Granny Smith and the cider night and day. Once again, it's about fruit quality. And people have to realize you just can't use any old fruit. And they also need to realize that these, especially in the Mid-Atlantic region where you still have a lot of these, quote, dessert apples, that they make really good cider. Jonathan is outstanding.
Or McIntosh, you know, I've made single variety McIntosh from a really old orchard up in Massachusetts.
Right.
And, you know, you just can't beat that. The trees are there, been there for 100 years. You know, it's going to be pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So,
and you know, location is so important because once again, in our little abandoned orchard that we work in, it slopes down to sort of like bottomland.
Oh, nice.
And so as you follow, as you're picking the Jonathan apples, as you get down into the bottomland, the apples start getting bigger, the trees are bigger, everything changes. So you really have to think about where you plant the orchard. And that's like what the next 25 years is all going to be about. What variety in what location does well.
Yeah. Geez, Scoot, you're really bringing so much to the table here for people to think about. I'm so excited. And it just... If you're not drinking a cider while you're listening to this, I know that you're going to run out and want to get one because, you know, that just that image of biting into the apple and it's almost like it kind of drips down the outside of your cheeks. You could see that there's so much potential on so many different levels.
Yes.
And I think it's really, really neat what you're doing there.
When you do it in a rustic style, there are so many nuances to play with that I don't care if everybody does our style, everybody does the rustic style, that they won't be making what I'm making just because you can. I mean, we do batonnage where we're stirring the lees and we do some barrels with, some barrels without. And how long do you age it in the barrel? Because you will get the development of these flavors and aromas in the first 2 months that then disappear. And 4 months later, something else emerges. And it just blows me away. Yeah.
So how often do you do that style of cider making, batonnage? Do you do, and can you just talk a little bit about that for folks who aren't familiar with that? Is that something that you're doing every year and they could?
In a certain number of barrels.
Okay.
Let's say we have 20 Jonathan barrels. We'll just say, hey, let's do half of them with batonnage and see what we get. Once again, let's get some diversity in our barrels. And so in the barrels, there's going to be lots of lees that settle out. So fragments of apples, dead and dying yeast, the lactic acid bacteria. And if you just let them sit there on the bottom, there's not a whole lot of interaction between those solids and the liquid. So we go in there with a stainless steel stirring rod and just 10 times. And it stirs it up off the bottom, gets it mixing, and just speeds up the interaction.
Do you ever do any keeving?
I've not done keeving. That looks really hard. And I'm not necessarily looking to make a sweet, tight style cider. We have so many other things on our plate right now to play with that there's a couple things that I would like to try, but they're way down on the list, and that's keeping. Looks very difficult.
Well, I just talked to Neil from Worley Cider, and he did a very detailed chat with me on keeving.
Yeah.
That was just pretty exciting. And you could do it at a very small, 5 gallon carboy level.
Right.
And he really recommends having it in the glass versus the barrel so you could see it,
right.
At least your first time. And I don't think it would really lend itself so well in a barrel.
Right. I'm not sure how we would do that. Or even a stainless steel tank. And it sounds like it could be a hit or miss thing until you perfect it.
Yeah.
And right now, what we're doing is so much, I think, easier.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's necessary. I mean, and a different product.
Everybody has their own style in cider making, and it's all good.
No, I applaud the folks that do that.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah. And back at you. So here's something I always kind of like to ask. So is it cider maker one word or cider maker two words?
Which would you like?
Well, I don't know. How do you define yourself? Do you call yourself a cider maker? Do you a cider master? Or just kind of
nobody's a cider master, unless I would give Tom Oliver cider master. Anybody's been making it in England, but I think in the U.S., I don't think people have a broad enough base of knowledge for anybody to be a cider master. I really don't. If you're making the Angry Orchard style, well, unless you've made my style, you don't know everything. And I've not made an Angry Orchard style, so I don't know the complexities of that job.
Enough.
But
yeah.
I would say cider maker is one word, I guess.
Yeah.
Just I think that's what people are familiar with.
Yeah, I'm just curious, because I think this is just hard for the consumer, right? And you and I had a little conversation on that just, online about consumers and trusting the consumer, but also being clear to the consumers of what's going on with the trade, so it could get a little confusing.
Right.
So that's just been my own little,
No, and you have to trust the consumers. The people will speak out, and I don't know if you saw, we were very fortunate, and it's a data point, but ratebeer.com gave us the number one cider in the U.S., and actually the number two, which was our hop, number one was Farmgate, number two was Hopvine, number five was our Rueberry, which is strawberry rhubarb.
And that just happened. This is 2016.
Yeah.
This is going live. And that just happened on Rate
Beer. And it's sort of interesting because you can go back through the years on Rate Beer and you could see who was winning what. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't necessarily, I hope we have a lot of competition in the coming year for that style. And because competition is good for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. And so I'm really hoping that we see some other ciders up there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just thrilled to be able to chat with you and hear what you're doing.
You do a great job.
Oh.
Love your chats.
Thank you. Well, it's a privilege and honor to be able to talk to so many amazing folks, and I feel like I'm in my own like little university here, learning so many amazing tips. And we'll, you know, definitely get down to Millstone and try that. I just can't wait to try some of your ciders. I'll be dreaming about that tonight. I love the image of the barrels, too. It's just, that's a lot of barrels to be working with, so you're staying pretty busy down there.
It does. It does stay busy, and but, you know, for me, some people would want to be writing it all down. I'll tell you that we do absolutely no lab analysis. I don't test alcohol. I don't test once you're not doing sulfur dioxide, pH, who cares?
Is that okay to have that out in the world that you don't? Do you know what your alcohol level is?
We test the sugar when it comes in the door, and we have to be above 7%. You get a range.
Right.
We're definitely within the legal range of what we have in the label.
Sure you are.
Yeah, so at this point, the only thing I would really like to do is get a spectrophotometer and start testing tannins. Mm-hmm. That I could do some interesting studies on tannins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But otherwise, it doesn't really mean it. And the thing is, we have been changing every year. Something gets tweaked and we change every year.
Sure.
So knowing all that past data really doesn't serve me anything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get me anywhere. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, you're doing it very in your own unique style, and that's what you could do when you're making cider. You could create your own style and your own way to do that. And boy, you know, I think you did show the possibility and also the really accessibility for folks hearing this, whether they are commercial cider makers or not. You know, there's barrels out there. Grab a barrel, put some cider in it, and be fearless.
Right, right. Or a carboy, you know.
Yeah,
for
exactly.
the folks at home,
hell yeah.
It is so easy. Your neighbor has a bunch of apples on the ground every year that the deer are eating. Mm-hmm. Say, can I have them? Just pick them off the ground. We don't wash our apples. I mean, we're not, if we were a brewery, that might be an issue, but we're not a brewery, we're a winery. So
I'm sure if they're filled with, like, dirt and stuff, you wash them.
I wash most of those.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, let's, we'll end with this and get the connections for Millstone Cellars on the show notes here and the website and social media contact too, and really encourage folks to go down to Maryland and check it out.
Okay. I did bring a bottle, by the way.
Oh, awesome.
Okay. So we can try that. Farmgate.
Oh my goodness. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
I'd like to thank Curtis Shear once again for spending the time with me and bringing along that bottle of Farmgate. I did bring it back to my little land of Ciderville and had it actually this weekend with Jim Wallace as we were trying some cheese pairings. So you'll hear us talking quite a bit about the Millstone cider during that upcoming episode. And it was simply unbelievably delicious. I do agree with Kurt that it's kind of like that sidra. There's a bit of that acidity that is very quenching, and it has that farmyard type of wild yeast, but it blended so nicely. Super delicious. I cannot wait to go down and visit Millstone Cellars at the soonest opportunity possible, and I hope you get to go there too. I imagine with the spring coming up is a very good time. Such a likable guy, obviously super educated and so approachable. And I love the idea of putting cider in big barrels and working with it and what he does, how he sets it up and tastes it. You want to go to that Martha Stewart article because there's some great photos where he puts the different glasses from each single variety apple that he has fermented and is tasting that out and has like a blending chart on a piece of slate. And you could see how he separates it out on the slate board with chalk and like little squares. It's kind of like a periodic table of sorts, just from a quick glance. But he's doing some really cool magic there. And we were going so fast in that chat, it was just accelerated. So we didn't actually get to speak about the third cider that he has quite often made down there, even though there's going to be more if you actually visit Millstone. But that's a ginger root. And I was just, you know, I couldn't stop asking him questions and interrupting him. And he was just so kind letting me do that. Oh, you know, that is the beauty of Ciderville. So thanks again, Kurt. You're awesome. Now, I'd like to thank the good folks at Cider Cellars for reaching out to me and saying, hey, we want to help keep the chat thriving so you could continue to connect Ciderville with all these amazing cider folk around the world. And because they reached out to me and wanted to help this podcast succeed, I in turn want to help their new business thrive too. Because that's the way we roll in Ciderville. Don't you know? There's a link to their website at ciderchat.com, or you can merely Google Cider Cellars. And that's cellars as in the place you store your barrels. And when you connect with them, tell them that you heard about their award-winning UK farmhouse ciders from this here podcast. Because I think if you don't have farmhouse ciders on your mind right now, I don't know if you've been listening to this podcast today with Kurt Scheer. Thinking that some of you, in fact, many of you might be thinking, I'd like to support this chat too. Well, I have a media kit and I'm always looking for more sponsors to help keep this chat thriving. Send me an email, ria@ciderchat.com, and I'll send that media kit right out to you. Well, it's time for me to go down to the barrel and open up that spigot and try a little bit of cider to wet my whistle. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. I look forward to seeing you in Ciderville.